I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the episode-by-episode breakdown of Red Dwarf. It's the triple fried egg chili chutney sandwich of podcasts. I'm Fergus, co-host and devotee.
I'm John, and I am watching this for the first time in ages. We're joined by our producer, Alex. This time, we're looking at Series 2, Episode 5, Queeg, with Sarah Mills.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company had evolved cat and a hologram he hates. Plus a fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
John, today's episode is going to be brilliant. Today's guest is in a league of her own. She's a brilliant stand-up. She recently joined the likes of Rosie Jones and Chris Packham in the Disability Power 100. She's an actor, a writer, a producer. She can do it all. But what she's doing for us right now is being a Red Dwarf fan. It's Sarah Mills!
Yeah! It's cold outside and I'm inside talking about Red Dwarf. Have you cleared the shot at the song? You probably can't have that,
We will now that you've done that.
Yeah, all right.
That's about as much of it as we can afford to do legally, I think.
Okay, fabulous.
So what was the first time you saw Red Dwarf? When was the first time you remember going, oh, that's a thing I like?
It was just a childhood thing growing up. My dad was really into it. So I ended up watching it. And I think it is one of my favourite shows of all time, if not my favourite show, my entire favourite show of all time.
But you were saying before we started recording just now that you're not necessarily a fan of sci-fi. So it was all about the comedy and the sit of it rather than the sci-fi.
Yeah, I'm not, because I see you in your house, Fergus, and I see you have a lot of models.
There's a lot of geekery going on here.
There's a lot of geekery, and that made me think of it, really. I was like, this is interesting, because this is the one part of me that is very geeky. And I really do mean geeky in that sort of, actually probably quite unfair definition of the term, where it's like you're into sci-fi, you're sort of into the sort of canon of these really long-standing stories. And I'm just not, there's nothing like that I'm into apart from Red Dwarf. So I don't know what it is about Red Dwarf that tickles that itch for me. But I think, do you know what? There's just something, it's the kind of thing I think I would have, like, I'm jealous of it, I have to say. Like, I would love it if it didn't exist and I could go, as a writer, because I'm a writer and I'm always, like, trying to come up with new ideas. And I wish I lived in a world where there isn't a sitcom set on a spaceship that's lost in the depths of deep space, because that is the kind of idea I'd love to come up with and write.
I know what you mean.
So I think it's just the world of it and the idea of it. It's, do you know what it is? It's a very, very grand idea done in a very traditional British sitcom way. And I think there's something really wonderful about that. And you don't really get that in a lot of other sitcoms. There are sort of, you know, because in Britain, we do sitcom really well in terms of like day-to-day miscellany, the sort of mini sort of meltdowns and social like interactions that come from just living in close quarters with people. But I think Red Dwarf possibly stands in a league of its own where it's got all of that sort of very small but wonderful stuff that goes on in British sitcom. But then it's got just this insane, huge universe of a world framing it.
Mm. Yeah.
Because, you know, other sitcoms at the time, Only Fools and Horses in a house, Allo Allo in a hotel.
They're fairly mundane settings, aren't they?
Very mundane settings. And then you just... And I know it's kind of silly because Red Dwarf, obviously, especially in the early series, still looks like it was made in someone's garage. But at least, like, the imagination, like, the scope of what it's creating is there. And actually, I think that what they've done as the series have progressed to, where are we up to now, series 12?
Yeah,
I feel like they've actually really beautifully, like, with the power of what you can do in the 2020s and the 2010s, I feel like they've managed to like scale up the graphics and the sets and stuff without sort of losing that tin pot feel. They've done it really nicely.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I think, you know, all the greatest sitcoms all sort of follow the same pattern that Red Dwarf is also proven to be, which is an ensemble cast of oddballs that you want to spend time with.
I'd question whether or not we want to spend that much time with them. Can we talk about Rimmer a little bit in that context?
Yeah, of course.
I feel like he's a classic British sitcom character, self-loathing, yeah, self-destructive, all that good stuff. Why do we want to spend time with him, given how despicable he is?
You always like a character that makes you feel better about yourself. So, like, you can be high status alongside Rimmer. I mean, yeah, his life is so unrelentingly depressing and, like, marked by underachievement in any field that he could want to achieve in. But, yeah, he is also so repugnant. But, yeah, you love to spend time with him. He's probably the funniest character in it. I think you do feel sorry for him. I think you do end up feeling fondly for him. They're very good at giving him these moments of bathos. And they do this very well across the whole scope of Red Dwarf. There's a few monologues in there across every series where they sort of interest... It's just a character sort of lamenting on their life back on Earth or some, you know, something that happened. Because their lives would have been sad even if they'd never got on Red Dwarf.
It feels Rimmer certainly would have been.
Yeah. You can't help but feel sorry for the boy whose parents didn't really love him and packed him off to boarding school and then space at camp and whatever else. And also, he does have moments, I always think with Rimmer, he has moments of being quite romantic. Like, he's the one in the very final episode of series 6. Doesn't he grab the gun and he goes to like shoot the machine that, like, it's Rimmer who's like leaning over Crichton going, what were you going to say? What's the... And he's very true, heroic in that moment. For some reason, the most heroic moment across the whole of every series, they give it to Rimmer, even though Lister is really the heroic one.
Yeah. It's cathartic, though, isn't it? To see someone be called a coward, like, 100 times, and for them to finally do something.
Yeah, yes.
And he really... Chris Barry sells the acting in that bit as well. Like, he's desperate in that scene.
Yeah.
And it is climactic. It is exciting, that moment. He's really good.
I think he's the best actor in the first six series. He is the best actor. I think later, you know, I think they catch up with him, the rest of the cast, and possibly overtake him in the later series. But yeah, he really does sell it.
He's an amazing actor, isn't he? As you say, could that be to do with the complexity of the character? Maybe he's got more to get his teeth into than Lister, who's a simple soul, really.
Well, I think Chris Barry does have a lot in common with Rimmer, perhaps. You know, I think his dad is military.
Oh, right, yeah.
And, you know, I think he is from a sort of upper middle class background. And often those kinds of backgrounds can be quite cold. So I think he probably brings a lot of himself to that role, to be honest. And you only have to look at Britas to see that, you know, they were quite similar characters. I mean, of course, you know, you would write the Britas character for the man who played Rimmer, and he might be completely different to both of those characters. But I think there's probably a little bit of Chris in Rimmer.
Yeah, that's right. Do you have a favourite era of Red Dwarf? Did you stop watching it any?
No, I've never stopped watching. I think I probably didn't commit as much to like series 8, and then series 9 is the special, isn't it?
Yeah, Back to Earth. Yeah.
I have watched them all at least once or twice because I do still love it. And actually, I think that Dave did a really great job of returning to form, being quite loving with the format and getting a really loyal version of the show when they took it on. But yeah, I think my favourite era is sort of 4 to 5 to 6. You've got to have Crichton.
Yeah, that's a big thing, isn't it? Do you have a particularly favourite episode in amongst all that?
Yes, I absolutely do. And it's the one, because it's the one that really sums up Red Dwarf and what's so great about it for me. It's the one where Lister plays snooker with planets, which I looked up, and it's called White Hole, and it's in series 4.
Oh, there's so many good bits in that episode. Played for and got. I'd say that every time I play pool. Even if I don't sink the ball, I'll still say played for and got.
Just where do you come up with that idea? Like, that idea is such a wonderful, fabulous idea. And I also, I mean, I like it because it's in the books as well, that that particular story is in the books. Mm. But yeah, so that's my favourite episode because I think that's just a really, such a clever idea.
It's also got John's favourite conversation in all of Red Dwarf in it, hasn't it?
It does indeed. I've never seen one before. No one has. But I believe it is a white hole. So what is it, that whole bit? It's fantastic.
Where Kat says, so what is it, over and over again.
Yeah, such good writing.
It's a brilliant, brilliant sequence. I love it. I guess, yeah, asking for a favourite episode is a controversial question, but then we can get more controversialer with this next question because it is contentious. It's sacrilegious. We know you could never replace the cast of Red Dwarf. However, if you had to, actually, let's go to your pre-Red Dwarf state. Imagine a world where Red Dwarf didn't exist and you had the idea to do exactly the sitcom in a kind of, what was that Danny Boyle film where the Beatles disappeared?
Yesterday.
Let's imagine Sarah Mills is in Yesterday, but instead of John Lennon, it's Doug Naylor. Who are you putting in the cast?
I am very happy with my selections. So for Lister, I would go Daisy May Cooper.
Yes. Brilliant.
Right? Yeah, right? Thank you. For Rimmer, brace yourselves, I think this is great. Rimmer, Nick Mohammed.
Oh, yes. This is really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very you're nice. Nailing it so far.
Yeah.
You're playing pool with planets here.
For Crichton, I'd go Matthew Bainton, who's in Ghosts.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think he could do a great Crichton. And then for Kat, I went for Susan Wacoma.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, a very different kind of cat, but nevertheless, she could do a cat brilliantly.
And then for Holly, Kate McKinnon.
Okay, you've just rung my magic bell, frankly, with Kate McKinnon. Like, I believe Kate McKinnon could play whatever she wants in anything. Yeah, that was a bit of a treat watching Barbie, actually. Her and America Ferrara are two of my favourite comic actors.
She'd be a crazy Holly.
She'd be a brilliant Holly. And affordable, because she'd be able to kind of just film at home and send her video.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking, Fergus.
Wow, what a strong cast. I'd watch the flip out of that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Nick Mohammed.
Pairing. It is, because he's so lovely, clearly, but he's started over the last few years to play slightly more despicable characters, right?
Yeah,
his character in Ted Lasso.
Yeah.
Oh, what an arc.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because Rimmer's evil comes from his sort of self-loathing and also his sort of rigid dedication to routine and ritual and paperwork. And I just think I can see Nick Mohammed having just great fun with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That with that just an edge of cluelessness he manages to keep.
Exactly.
When he's doing something really nasty.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, Rimmer is quite stupid.
It's hard to remember that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think there's something about the accent that makes you assume education and authority, therefore. But actually, no, he's thick.
Yeah, maybe that's the joke they were making all along, frankly.
Politically, I've always found Red Dwarf quite interesting. There's, 50% people of colour in the cast. It seems to be a really blokish show, but women love it just as much as men, it seems.
I've been thinking about this a lot because obviously I watched it when I was a kid and it did not bother me that there weren't girls in it. And watching it back, I think that it works. It wouldn't have the same energy with women there because it has to be four straight dudes cooped up together. You know, that's such a strong part of the misery of their lives and the humour is that they are stuck in space not getting their ends away. But also, I think that these three men, I'm not going to speak to Crichton's sex life, because, you know, but the three men at least,
well, let's hope.
I don't think they'd be getting laid that much if they were back on Earth anyway. Like, I think this idea that their lives would be much different if they didn't get stuck on Red Dwarf is a little bit of a leap. And I wouldn't want to see another show now commissioned with four men across it. The thing is, you can always have blokey shows. It's just that through the 90s and before that, you only had blokey shows. So this is what I think what I'd say in conclusion. It was four blokes stuck in space. Any woman that came up in conversation, it was largely, the joke was that she had nice boobs or a nice bum or what have you. And I don't think that's a problem if you also have shows where, you know, a gang of women can talk about men in that way. And actually, we do have that now, so it's fine.
Does an all-female version of the show work?
I think so, yeah. You can imagine, like, the cast of Smack the Pony being Red Dwarf. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, for sure.
I think we imagine that if it was women, then they'd all be, like, super clean and functional. And but we forget, and this is a very important point, guys, women can be losers too. Say it with me.
Thank you for making that
point. Women can be losers too. I think we don't think it would work with girls because we think of girls as being like competent and shiny and contoured. And actually, that yes, certain women are, but there are a lot of women. Like, I'm sat here with my dinner on my top and I don't care. I think that you could definitely do it.
One last little idea from me. This is a weird question maybe, but if you did have Daisy May Cooper as Lister and Nick Mohammed as Rimmer, do you think every episode they'd have to re-express their physical dislike of each other to avoid there being any kind of like sexual chemistry between them?
Yeah, I thought about this. I do think it's possible to write a male and a female character and not have sexual chemistry. You know, and also the character that Daisy May Cooper plays in This Country is pretty asexual. I could see her bringing that sort of asexual quality to Lister. And, you know, when you're talking about like an updated version of it now, you're not trying to find someone to play Lister exactly as Lister is. So I think I thought of Daisy May Cooper because she does sort of Clueless quite well. And you can see her sort of being that sort of version of Lister that has to sort of learn the ship from the bottom upwards, from being like the absolute loser on the ship. You know, you can see her bringing lots of loser tendencies to it. I'm not sure you'd see her. I don't know. Maybe she would be super horny, but just have a bit of like that, the cat's like naivety around sex. So maybe she'd like pretend to be horny, but actually be asexual. I don't know, but I feel like you would buy the fact that Daisy May Cooper and Nick Mohammed, the two characters they play, wouldn't be desperate to bone all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd hope you wouldn't have to keep saying it. Enough sexy time. Should we get to talking about Queeg?
Oh my God, what did you just say to me, Fergus?
I said, it's only so much we can handle.
I did not think when coming on this Red Dwarf pod that anyone would say to me, enough sexy time.
So John's going to take us through a little summary of the episode we're going to be chatting about. Let's hear from you. John.
It's season 2, episode 5. Queeg. We open with a very rare example of Holly's introductory gag feeling like a relevant setup to the episode. The only thing stopping him going space crazy through loneliness is the friendship he shares with his collection of singing potatoes. It's really nice to have a timeless punchline as opposed to what we more often get, which is a now quite dated social or cultural reference, sort of like Seinfeld in space. Into the episode itself, the crew is kind of kicking around. Lister's doing a magazine quiz to assess his sexual vibrancy as a woman, while Kat is rocking out to a chewed-up audiobook of Tessa the D'Urbervilles. Rimmer is trying to beat a scutter at chess by running down the clock. Holly pops up to warn them of a meteor strike, but he only remembers after it hits. Trying to fix the damage to the hologram simulation suite, Rimmer cycles unwillingly through a series of traumatic impressions slash possessions, while Lister is almost blown up when Holly tells him to connect the wrong cables. This triggers the appearance of Queeg 500. He's the backup computer, assuming control of the vessel due to Holly's gross negligence endangering personnel, and he is, to say the least, a hard taskmaster. Holly is demoted to night watchman, Rimmer is tortured through exercise, Lister and Kat are put to work scrubbing. Come back, Holly, all is forgiven. Well, he tries a counter coup, challenging Queeg to the game of his choice, chess. Despite Holly's best efforts with his horses, bishes and prawns, he loses. Double check and mate, sucker. As Holly's erased, he poignantly sings the Carpenter's classic Goodbye to Love, which incidentally with its singular fuzz guitar solo is credited as the first ever power ballad. But that's not important right now. Because Holly is dead. But that's not important right now, because Holly is not dead. As Queeg's stern visage transitions into the face of the greatest and most prolific lover who ever lived, see season one episode, Balance of Power, Holly reveals he has pulled off the jape of the decade. He was Queeg all along. The moral of the story is, appreciate what you've got, because basically, Holly is fantastic. So, a lot of stuff happens in this episode. Meteor strike, Rimmer losing control of his body, Lister blown up, Holly usurped, Queeg's reign of terror, life on the dwarf transformed, a battle of wits lost by a character we love, condemning him to be erased. Considering how it all resolves as one big prank, as it goes along, it feels like a really high-stakes, incident-packed episode, I think.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Sarah, you're the one who's got a BAFTA for TV comedy writing. What do you think of it?
I love the episode. I remember really loving it the first time round. You know, I think it's one of those episodes that really does a great job of showing the world building that they've done and, you know, really enjoying like the sort of scope that they've got with a sitcom that's set in space. The image of Rimmer running around the deck while also being unconscious.
Yeah.
You won't get that on any other show. That's such an absurd image. Like, brilliant. Like, that is just gold.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And that line that he has, help me, Lister, it's Queeg, he's making me fit. That is just such great writing.
Yeah.
I adore that. It's so good.
It's great. I hadn't thought of that. That's brilliant.
Although him complaining about having a big belly after that scene where he's stick thin in a flipping... All right.
Chris Barry pulls off that boxer shorts and vest combination very, very effectively, I think. But I think he's got some all-timer moments in this episode, actually, Chris Barry. That is his impressions in the simulation suite when he's cycling through the other crew members.
Oh, he's brilliant.
Is awesome. It's really nice to see him, you know, being Cat randomly. It's just lovely. So much,
yeah.
So much of Chris Barry's kind of, you know, his impressionistic skill on display there.
Yeah, I think he's underrated. It really made use of his skills of impersonation for sure. You know, knowing he'd been on Spitting Image before, they lent into it that episode.
Yeah, they really did. And it pays off beautifully because he gets a hell of a lot to cram into that scene, doesn't he? I also love the line he has when they're talking about Holly's decline, and he's got this amazing... Grant Naylor are brilliant at writing these kind of things where they swerve you, even though you know the character. Mm. They make you think they're going one way. So he's like a blind, old, incompetent sheepdog talking about Holly. Take him out to the barn and blow the mother away. And then he says, and I'm only saying that because I'm so fond of him. It's just a world of pain and internalised hatred kind of just wrapped up in that.
Yeah.
Chris Barry's superb. And I think Norman Lovett is magnificent in this episode. It's a real showcase for him. So I've not seen this since the 90s. So I'd completely forgotten what the twist is.
Oh, nice.
I totally forgot.
Yeah, I think I'd forgotten as well.
Had you? Oh, that makes me feel better.
Yeah, I think so.
What I love about it is it's a great moment, especially because they've built up the stakes so much and you have no idea what's coming. But also, it really does reward repeat viewing once you know what the twist is. So I've seen it a couple of times in preparation for this. And the second time through, when you know that it's all a setup, there's so much fun to be had in seeing the choices that Norman Lovett's made.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. No, it's great. Have you got any sort of standout Holly moments from this ep?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, where he's suddenly wearing a flat cap.
Yeah.
To the carpenter's tune. I don't like.
So good.
Yeah, it's the whole sort of miners' strike echoes going on.
Yeah.
But also, I do just like the phrase "jape of the century." Like, jape is such a great word.
It is, isn't it?
And that, you know, it's such great economy in the writing that they just give him that moment of victory, and then they're just out of the episode. That's it.
Yes,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
Punchline hit, credits. That's it.
Yeah,
brilliant stuff. Yeah,
yeah.
Don't see any reaction shots, you know, but because the victory is Holly, so why would you cut to anyone else?
And the delight will be in imagining them reacting after the episode's finished.
Yeah.
How livid they're going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's great that. They really rattle off the memorable phrases there. Because, you've got Jape of the Decade is great. That's immediately followed by April, May, June, July and August Fool, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
And Wheeze of the Week I love as well.
Wheeze of the Week. Also, my other favourite thing is his version of the chess pieces.
Oh, like yes.
Like Horsey, Bish and Prawn.
I
mean, sometimes
that.
You've got to go for what's right in front of your face. What would Holly call a pawn? a prawn.
Yeah.
But actually, when you know that he actually does know what they're called and that's him faking, that's quite interesting, really.
It is.
Yeah, he knows the crew really well. And actually, funny enough, as he's saying goodbye to Lister and Rimmer and Kat, he says some pretty, not cruel things, but things that he seems to want them to wake up to, to be aware of, you know what I mean? Like, he does say, like, I hope you achieve all the things that you think are going to make you happy.
Yes, that's great.
To Rimmer. That's quite insightful in terms of, like, an intended parting gift that turns out to be a gag. He's still getting to what the three of them want to hear. And I think that he's been doing that all episode, right? Maybe all series.
Oh, I like that. I guess it is kind of, but it is that sort of thought experiment, isn't it? What would you say to people if you thought it was your last day on earth, kind of thing, like, you know, if you could attend your own funeral, what would you do? And that's what Holly sort of gets a chance to do,
and entirely of his own volition as well, or to teach them a lesson, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
Would you want to attend your own funeral just to see?
Oh god, yeah, who wouldn't want to attend their own funeral? Everyone crying because I no longer exist and talking about how great I am, of course. Jesus.
Yeah, that does sound pretty good.
Yeah. See which of my ex-boyfriends turn up. Love that for me. Yeah, and, you know, like, someone's done your entire makeup as well. Brilliant.
Yeah, really set it in place.
Do you know that they have to have a special type of makeup for funeral homes?
Do they?
Because your skin, the nature of your skin starts to obviously change once death has taken place. So they have to have a different type of makeup for dead skin.
Bloody that makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. God, sweet dreams tonight. Now, speaking of the twist, Alex, do you want to chip in and tell us the really interesting, and this is really interesting actually, about the twist in this ep?
Sure. So Grant and Naylor had actually written the majority of the episode without having an ending, and it was something they had been painted into a corner, and they thought of the whole thing being a gag sort of last minute, and it so neatly ties everything together. That's very surprising.
Wow.
I love that.
To the extent that the cast didn't know?
I'm not sure of the timings. This would have been during writing.
Pre-production, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. You'd assume it was the idea from the start, surely?
Well, actually, you know what? I was watching it and I was like, this is really interesting because actually it doesn't follow strict story structure, because really what should happen if you're being sort of Catholic about script writing is that the solution should come from the characters, you know, something should happen from within them that undoes everything. But actually what really happens is it's kind of a little bit like, but it's a really great version of this, the ending, which goes, it was a dream all along. But obviously but that's to do it a disservice, really. I don't mean it in the way that, you know, people associate that with kind of poor plotting. I think it's fantastic plotting. And you're right, it just seems to fall into place anyway.
Can I ask a kind of nerdy literary question?
Please do. I love nerdy literary questions.
Well, we're talking about Crichton, and obviously it's spelt differently, but it's a reference to the Admirable Crichton, which is a play about a Victorian play about shipwreck. Queeg is a reference to Mutiny on the Bounty?
No, it's the Caine Mutiny, Queeg.
The Caine Mutiny. So, what was that?
So basically, the Caine Mutiny is a novel from 1952. And there's a character in that called Lieutenant Commander Philip Francis Queeg, who is brought in to captain a sort of post-war minesweeping vessel. He's taking over from a much more relaxed captain.
Oh.
He is a real authoritarian. But interestingly, he claims to like everything done according to regulations. He's actually a bit of a rotter, blaming others for all of his mistakes, and he smuggles liquor that he insists on his officers selling to him. So he gets relieved of his command by a subordinate when he fails to do the right thing during a storm.
Right.
The Queeg name comes, you know, directly inspired by that character.
Yeah.
The Mutiny on the Bounty bit
is
Holly's line, "This is Mutiny, Mr. Queeg."
Yeah.
That's a reference to "This is Mutiny, Mr. Christian."
Mr. Christian,
in
right.
Mutiny on the Bounty.
Because in my head, Crichton and Queeg are just such... Surely Sarah's a non-sci-fi fan, you can back me up on this. They sound so sci-fi. Like, if you were just asked to think of the worst sci-fi names, Queeg is surely up there.
Yeah, that is a really interesting... Yeah, that's really... I knew none of that, and I am delighted to learn it. And you're right, yeah. I was going to say the same thing. Queeg sounds like a space creature and nothing
else. Yeah, it's an alien, right?
It does, yeah.
Crazy.
Okay, well, let's talk about Queeg then. Do you know much about Charles Organs, Sarah?
No,
okay.
Tell me.
Right, so he's predominantly known as an Olivier Award-winning choreographer of stage musicals. He did have some sci-fi cred. He was in an episode of Blake 7 back in the day, but he's not primarily known as an actor. He's a dancer and a singer. So in the next episode of Red Dwarf, You may or may not remember, there's a dance sequence, spoiler alert for people who are watching this for the first time. There's a dance sequence in the next episode for Tongue Tied. And he was brought in to choreograph that.
No.
Yeah. And it seems that they were thinking about the casting of Queeg, so they must have filmed out of sequence, I guess. And Grant Naylor liked the cut of his jib, basically. So he comes in to play Queeg.
It's so crazy to me to get a dancer in your cast and then go, yeah, we're just going to film your head, mate.
Yeah.
You're just going to be a floating head. How's your hairography? Oh, you're bald. Never mind.
Charles Augens was a mentor for Danny John-Jules, and I think he'd gone to one of the dinners for the cast for Red Dwarf, and he was really impressed the writers at that, so they ended up finding a part for him.
He is very, very well cast.
Yeah, perfect.
He's got real Queeg energy, hasn't he? It's brilliant.
He's got big Queeg energy.
He's even got a little bit of the nasty guy in Full Metal Jacket. You know, the soldier that runs the boot camps in those films. He's always a taskmaster's the word for it, isn't it? Just really punishing people for being alive, it seems.
Yeah, just bellowing at people.
Sounds dreadful.
Yeah. I've got another cool Charles Augens fact.
Yes.
So Charles Augens' most awesome credit, aside from Queeg, he choreographed the dance sequences for Magic Dance and Chili Down in the movie Labyrinth.
Oh!
No!
And
that's amazing.
He voiced the puppet character, Fiery Number 2, in Chili Down. That's the first Fiery that has his head taken off and used as a basketball. Augens can't do that in real life, and he's sick of being asked.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Big question for me, is he reading his lines or is he just not sure what his eye line should be? Because he's definitely darting around a little bit from time to time if you watch as closely as I did.
I think he must be reading his lines.
His eyes carry on moving between his lines as well. And I'd say like in that kind of close-up, where they want quite a short lens to make sure everything's just flattened in the background. It could have been right, like a few inches from his face, potentially, that lens. And it isn't like an eye where you can look right into the pupil. Oh, I don't know. Because I did see some movement, but I'm just such an apologist for all of this stuff. I was
me too.
He's just looking around the room. It's fine. Yeah, he's looking at Rimmer and then Lister and Rimmer, Lister.
Well, I mean, this is it, isn't it? It's a bit unfair. I'm not casting shade on Charles Augens. I think Queeg is a fantastic character. I love that. Drill sergeant energy, as you say, that he brings to it is
drill sergeant. Thank you.
He's great.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you are under like lots of lights like that, I do think, you know, and cameras and what have you, I do think that is a reaction you might have, to be fair to him.
He might be looking for like micro transgressions amongst the crew, possibly. He's just constantly darting around going, is there a smudge on that scutter or that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, it might be in a deliberate direction. Always be scanning the situation.
Yeah, totally.
It's possible.
I think the 5 mile stair thing is very sinister. So I think his eye line, even if it's an accident, there's something very haunting about it. I mean, you definitely believe that they have been mutinied.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's got quite a lot of power, including what he can do with Rimmer's body for a start. But, you know, he's just a face on a screen, isn't he?
I think it's commanding, though.
It is.
Incredibly commanding. Really haunting, I think.
These days, you could not have any performance that combines haunting and sucker. He says the word sucker a lot.
It's true.
And he still makes it sound like, you feel like, I should be laughing at that in this day and age. Someone saying sucker.
Yeah.
I should be finding that a bit silly, but he sells it. He's all right. He's fine. He can, If he called me a sucker, I would not laugh. I would probably cry a little bit, if anything.
Yeah, I think sucker needs to come back into the lexicon, doesn't it?
Well, let's do it, guys. That can be the thing that we achieve with this piece of broadcasting.
Yes, all right. I think do me a lemon needs to be in common parlance as well.
Do me a lemon.
Do me a lemon. That is such a... I mean, what? Where does that even come from? I love it. You know, the bit about shoes and artificial intelligence, so the smart shoes, Peterson.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that I love in Red Dwarf.
So I hear this opening line, sometimes I think it's cruel giving machines a personality. And I went, oh, great, this is going to be really timely, interesting comment on AI, given where the real world is with all of that at the moment. I wonder what they were saying about it in 1988. So I started transcribing, ended up transcribing the whole thing. And then I obviously get to the end and I realised that, well, I am a sucker.
The whole thing is a joke.
Yeah, because it's just a big setup for a cheap pun. It's unbelievable. So I literally was Rimmer in that moment.
Yeah, I kind of love the story and feel a bit sad when you get that sucker punch at the end. However, what I do like is that they clearly are existing in a world where they have robot shoes. So, you know, even if that bit is a joke... the robot shoes still exist because Rimmer doesn't turn around and go, what are you talking about? There's no such thing as shoes that can just march along. Like,
quite right.
You know, the story didn't happen, but the shoes still exist in this world.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. And it's still such a good story. The choices he's making. Fell asleep in Oslo and woke up in Burma.
Yes.
That's brilliant. Yeah. What a brilliant pair of choices.
Yeah,
it is great, and it's really nicely delivered as well. Craig Charles, he doesn't give away the fact that it's going to turn out to be a Shaggy Dog story at all.
And it's such a melancholy image as well, the fact that the shoes wanted to live.
Yeah,
let the shoes live.
Yeah, they were bored, they just wanted to see the world. Yeah, so okay, should we have robot shoes?
Well, to be fair, this is what the show The Wrong Trousers is all about.
Oh, yes, it is.
I think they have robot shoes in there, and I think that is another sobering warning about what AI could truly look like in real life. Because if you remember rightly, Wallace does get, in a similar way to Rimmer actually, he gets literally carried away by the robot shoes. So I think we should take that very solemn warning about the future of AI and maybe slow it down a little bit.
No, you're right. It's not the first time I've asked a question that turns out to have been answered in Plasticine before as well.
But no, we should not have robot... Why would we need robot shoes?
To take us home when we're drunk, apparently.
That's the rationale here.
Can I just say that the best shoes that ever happened were when we were kids and there was a brand of shoes that had like a little toy key in the soles.
Oh yeah, really? I remember those.
Like, that was the nadir of shoe technology, and it's been downhill since.
What was the point of the key? Did it open something?
No, I think you just had a secret key in your shoe. Lovely. I need no more information. Key in the shoe, brilliant. £20 more. Thank you, Clarks.
Does it unlock anything? Don't care.
Your imagination.
I think there was a lock in the shoe.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Could you keep anything in it?
Your feet.
Since we're on memories of being young, so the bit right at the beginning where Lister is doing a magazine quiz for women and he gets mostly sees you sure are one foxy lady.
Yeah.
Does anyone else remember doing that kind of thing?
Yes.
Pre-internet, due to the lack of sort of bespoke anti-boredom mechanisms on tap. You just pick up an old magazine designed for someone completely unlike you, grown up, and you just start answering the questions anyway because you're bored.
It's usually GP waiting room.
Yes.
Do that quiz.
Yeah, I missed that.
My friends once did one of those quizzes for me because I had 7 boyfriends and I needed to like whittle them down, so they did like one of these, like,
how'd you have the time?
I was 16 and like so they did, you know, because this was the height of like Sugar magazine that would have those kind of surveys, so they did that for me, but like it was like a tick box exercise to decide which boy I should pick out of these 7 boyfriends I had.
That's a pretty cool brag, not just that you had 7 boyfriends but also that there was a magazine that had an article about how to decide between your 7 boyfriends.
No, my friends did it for me. They sat and they did all the questions. They wrote the questions.
Oh, they my wrote the questions? Oh, I see, right.
Yeah, my friend, yeah. They were like, oh, Sarah needs to decide because you can't keep dating these 7 different men. And so they came up with like a number of different like questions designed on those magazine.
That's brilliant.
A, B, C, or D. And it, you know, it was like, if it was mainly A's, it was this bloke. If it was mainly B's, you know, so yeah.
Was the outcome effective? Like, did it lead you to the right choice? Was it scientifically rigorous?
I mean, honestly,
rigorous?
I think in the end, I probably got dumped by most of them because they were like teenage boys in Stevenage.
They found out.
No, I don't know. But yeah, I don't think I agreed with the results, so I made a different choice. But I think a lot of them sort of petered out anyway.
Do you know what, though? That's really good friending.
It was, well, yeah, we had a lot of time on our hands back in the day.
Not if you had seven boyfriends. Seven boyfriends and a quiz. That's a lot to pack in.
I'm 43 years old. I don't think I've even had seven girlfriends.
In total, across your life?
No, I probably have.
What about Inflatable Eileen?
Hey, come on with the references.
I thought we might briefly talk about Red Dwarf.
It wouldn't be an episode of this podcast without making a quick detour to the BBC iPlayer. So, Sarah, something we've found with the iPlayer is that they have to write these very pithy summaries of the episodes to help the casual viewer decide if they're going to watch or not. So the teaser for Queeg, I'm going to honour the punctuation or lack thereof. It reads thus. Holly's behaviour begins to endanger the ship, so he's replaced by the backup computer. To which I can't help thinking the casual potential first-time viewer...
we're all waiting for the rest of it.
No, do you want to hear it again?
Yes, please.
Holly's behaviour begins to endanger the ship, so he's replaced by the backup computer. Full stop. There is no punctuation.
The backup computer.
I mean, I can't help but think, you know, the casual potential viewer there is likely to respond, yeah, sounds like a sensible decision. Glad that's sorted. Don't need to watch that one. Doesn't sound like there are any stakes. Is there a new Mrs. Brown's boys? It's just like, what are they thinking? Is it a tax dodge?
That's
Do they
crazy.
Not want people watching it? What's going on?
But are they all like
Yes,
that?
They're all bizarre. But
you would never know. Genuinely, if they didn't say cult classic sci-fi comedy elsewhere on the page, there is no way you would know it was a comedy.
I just think there are about a million more interesting ways you could sum up this episode in one sentence than that.
Give us five of them, John.
Holly is usurped by a powerful AI. Does he have the wits to stop Queeg's reign of terror?
You can end at one. That was brilliant. Yeah, great.
Anyway, back to the episode and the juice of the episode. Sarah, if you had to pick, what's your favourite bit, whether it's a line or whether it's a moment?
I think, actually, for me, Rimmer is very strong in this episode. It would have to either be between him running while asleep or doing impressions of everyone. Mm-hmm. I think probably... running while asleep is my favourite bit.
Yeah,
that's extraordinary.
That is fantastic character comedy.
Because it's also, do you know what it is? It, like, the show is never not a little bit dark. And it's actually a really dark thought to be like, in the future, you know, something could control your body and make you run even while you're unconscious. Like, that's a very dark idea. And so I think that's why I'm sort of drawn to it.
Do you know what? Even after the big twist reveal, it turns out it was Holly behind Queeg all along. You could read it as a threat from Holly. Do you know what I mean? You could read it as Holly saying,
yeah,
I can control your body when I want to, so don't mess me around, all right?
You really could. That's
I
a really
haven't
good
yet,
point.
But I can.
Very interesting.
He's not nasty.
Sarah, it's been so, so lovely having you on the podcast. Thank you ever so much
thank
for your
you.
Time and for your insights. I mean, what a treat.
Thank you for having me. This has been an absolute joy.
Good.
I love Red Dwarf and I would always love talking about Red Dwarf.
We can't let you go without asking, for those who've enjoyed your wonderful contributions, where can people find more of Sarah Mills?
I am on all your social media platforms at Sazzy Mills, SazzyMills.
Perfect.
Please do follow me.
Do it, guys, but not in a creepy way. Thank you so much.
I don't mind if you do it in a creepy way, frankly.
There you go. Green light. Sarah Mills there. Definitely the right dude for the gig. And I'm using dude in the unisex way there.
In the parallel universe sense of the word. That's next episode.
That's next. No spoilers.
Keep that powder dry. Yeah, what an ep. That was a lightning round.
It was a ton of fun, yeah.
We got to a lot of different stuff, but all of it very, very quickly. I guess that's the episode though, isn't it? It does zip along.
We pretty much touched on everything. I mean, I'm looking at my notes. I've got two things that we didn't talk about. First off, just to say kudos to Craig Charles for doing his own stunt there with the being blown up.
Oh yeah, that you can see his face. And do you reckon that was a budget thing, or Craig Charles going, no, let me do it, or Ed Bye going, no, we'd see his face if it was a stunt guy. I really want this shot because it'd be so cool. But yeah, lovely, lovely stunt.
I think he was just very up for it from the documentary, and he speaks of it proudly as well.
Sure, but at the same time, no producer is going to agree to that completely readily. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's surely Paul Jackson was either going, guys, do we not want to get a stunt guy in for this, or at least have a bit of stunt prep? or he wasn't in the room when they did that bit. And I think that the latter's more likely.
It was a different time before all the health and safety, right? It was, you know, it was very loosey-goosey on the set.
Yeah.
They probably all had a go. Who doesn't want to be launched over a big sci-fi desk with an explosion happening?
It's a cool moment.
It really is. And another cool Lister moment, just one of my favourite gags in the episode that for some reason didn't come up. Lister gets a pea on toast for dinner.
Yeah.
That is just brilliant.
Perfect reaction to it. He's taking the smeg.
They're so good at food-related humour, actually. There's loads of... Like, whenever they have to do a food stuff, it's always just perfectly hilarious.
Yeah, that's true. You think in Legion, the dinner scene in Legion?
Oh, that cracked me up. I can vividly remember watching that for the first time. Just all of us falling about.
They are good with food. They're good with most things, though, aren't they? I think that's why, you know what, Sarah is clearly someone who... Well, she's just self-confessed, not a sci-fi fan. So it's quite interesting talking about a sci-fi sitcom where it does seem like she still really enjoys the big ideas in it.
Mm, yeah.
And interestingly, there weren't... Funnily enough, Queeg doesn't necessarily have enormous sci-fi ideas, those ones that make you question the soul. But they are doing an interesting discussion on authority, I guess, aren't they?
Mm.
And better the devil you know style psychology.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a real... It's that rug pull at the end just does... It does mean you almost don't go away thinking about anything other than, oh, what a hilarious twist.
Mm.
But actually, yeah, there's tons of stuff to unpack in there.
Yeah, not least, and we kind of touched on this so briefly in the episode just now, but it's quite easy to forget that Holly is Queeg, right? Everything that Queeg does, that was Holly doing that to them.
Mm.
So again, how forgiving of Rimmer and Lister.
Yeah.
Or Lister again, just to go, well, I guess he's still keeping me sane by driving me insane.
Yeah, right.
Cool.
And how much sharper is his intellect to be able to deliver Queeg's words, which he's making up on the spot?
That's very true. I guess first time you see the big Osborne Book of Planets or whatever it is that just edges into frame amazingly. That's, again, that's Holly's choice.
Yes.
When you first see that, you go, that's stupid. A computer wouldn't have a book in the screen with them. No, they wouldn't.
Yeah. He's that's just Holly setting it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the flat cap and all that. He's just setting them up for the ride. Yeah.
I was thinking about this too. Is it more like the thing with the appeal of Mac over Microsoft was things like having icons and an actual desktop where you didn't have to type in lines of code to open stuff. And like, if technology's continued to progress that way, maybe, and like the fact he is ahead himself, like it's a representation for ease of use. So you could make an argument that things like bringing up a book, it's so they understand the process and the code that's going on underneath to answer their questions. But yeah, that's a very apologist thing.
But then no, but then I think that's valid, but you start getting into kind of techno apologism where or even techno spirituality. Where does Holly exist? Does Holly only is Holly's what he wants to project is that he only exists on that wheeled trolley thing that he moves around in? It's only next episode where he has that gag about looking out of the wrong window.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of, because surely it's like some sensor over the whole ship.
It still begs the question, why end up with Holly? If that is how the tech evolved and we do have that 3D representational, and maybe the screen has sensors, all the screens have sensors on them so that wherever Holly appears facially as a head, he would be able to sense the environment that he's appearing in at that moment. All of those questions, that's solid tech geekery. However, why did they end up with Holly?
Best explanation was still the one John Robertson gave us about it being like, it's obviously something enormously powerful and potentially intimidating, so why would you not make the interface something cheerful and non-threatening?
Yeah, reassuringly normal and low status, yeah.
But you're right, it doesn't explain like the humour in that.
Yeah, maybe the senility explains the humour. I know we've been talking about it a lot over the last 11 episodes, but I still think it might be worth going back and having another rewatch, only fixating on Holly, truly fixating on how much the ship's computer is driven by the singular programming urge to keep Lister alive and how he goes about that. He doesn't do it very well. He lets them kind of go and play mimed rock gigs on planetoids nearby. It's all bets are off when it's 3 million years on, isn't it? Because computer senility, there you go, that explains everything. I do want to just, before we sign off, mention Sarah's casting as well. Mm. Or rather, the fact that, you know, we didn't acknowledge it when she said it, but Daisy May Cooper and Susan McComa are both repeats.
Yes.
They've been mentioned before. And I think that is fascinating. Daisy May Cooper is our generation's Dave Lister.
Yeah.
There's patterns emerging.
Yes.
Whenever we get repeated names, it's worth noting because that's a shared idea. That's almost a consensus rather than it's a popular idea rather than just some crazy,
yeah,
crazed loner.
It's starting to feel like there needs to be a version of Red Dwarf with Daisy May Cooper playing Lister. It's like the universe is willing it to happen.
I guess Nish, having appeared so many times in our recastings, will have to appear as either male version of Lister if Daisy May Cooper plays Lister, or either version of River in a parallel universe.
Or maybe we just have Red Dwarf colon Lister versus Lister versus Rimmer. I reckon we're about ready to say goodbye to Queeg, actually. And you know what? There's something else we're probably going to say goodbye to after this ep. I think this might be the last time we bang on about the iPlayer description.
Now we know.
Exactly.
Their provenance.
Yeah, we do. We know they're not dreadful web copy. They're dreadful Radio Times copy from years ago. It hardly seems worth getting exercised about. Fun as it is.
Oh, it's fun while it lasted. And if we do happen to see a particularly stringently bad one, we'll bring it up again.
Yeah, if they really don't meet our rigorous quality standards, we reserve the right to bring that bit back.
Sure.
But yeah, in the meantime, we will bid Queeg adieu. If you have anything you want to contribute to the debate on Queeg, on Series 2, on anything, if you just want to send us some hate mail, like the Carpenters got for that fuzz guitar solo.
What? Why?
Well, their fans felt that they'd gone hard rock. So they wrote a lot of angry letters. But yeah.
That's crazy.
Send us your angry letters to betterthanlifepod@gmail.com and we will see you next week.
That's right.
For some real hard rock in Parallel Universe.
With Stuart Goldsmith. Can't wait.
Yes!
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.